From the studios in the Communication Arts and Sciences Building on the campus of Michigan State University, this is MSU Today. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus by Russ White.
Thank you, Lynn. At 6 past 4 following news, Kirk Heinze discussions on GMOs.
We were very concerned that having it labeled as a GMO was almost like they were going to put a skull and crossbones on there.
And our important honeybee population.
A lot of these wild bees are very docile and wouldn't. They're not out to get you. They're busy getting pollen, getting nectar from the flowers.
We'll learn about CADA's clean commuting options later, too. MSU Today begins at 4:06.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes. My guest is Chloe White, who is the Clean Commute Options Coordinator for CATA. That's the Capital Area Transportation Authority. Chloe, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. We focus on transportation options that are better for the environment than driving yourself around in your car every day. And because driving yourself emits a lot of pollution, and that's not good for our air quality, that's not good for our community's health. And so we try and educate people on how their daily transportation habits really affect our community's air quality and thus our public health.
And let's back up a bit. How did the program even come into being? Why is it even there?
Back when the EPA amended the Clean Air Act in 1991, they changed the standards for acceptable level of pollution and acceptable air quality, and realized that it was going to be pretty hard for regions, states, whatever, to meet these new standards. So they created this thing called the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Program, which is essentially a way to provide grant money to those regions so that they can establish programs that will lead to improving their region's air quality. And sometime after this program was put in place, essentially the entire state of Michigan failed a federal air quality test. And so many of the regional transportation authorities in Michigan became eligible to receive that grant money. And that included the Tri-County region, which is Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton County. And CATA was awarded the grant funds to be responsible for that type of a program in our area.
So tell me more about some ways that people can commute cleaner.
We at Clean Commute Options define clean commuting as any mode of transportation that emits less per person emissions than driving alone in your car would. And there are many different modes that would fit that definition. The ones we focus on are obviously taking the bus. We're a bus company. But also biking or walking as some non-motorized options. And thirdly, carpooling or vanpooling.
And while we're talking about Lansing in specific, where you are with CATA, people interested in other parts of the state should just check with their transportation authority or rideshare program, because there are likely similar programs.
Exactly. The Tri-County region was not the only region in Michigan that failed that air quality test. I've worked with the Grand Rapids and Southeast Michigan versions of my program, and we're all pretty similar. We're all trying to make the same change for our communities.
And what are some of the ways you go about making people aware of this great program? Because I understand, for example, you have a duathlon coming up.
We try and put on fun, entertaining events that the public can come and attend that give them an opportunity to test out one of those clean commuting options that we're trying to promote, one of which is what you just mentioned, the duathlon. And that specifically allows the public to test out non-motorized transportation because it is a running and biking race. And it takes place this year at Lake Lansing Park South, and it is on Sunday, September 11th. Race kicks off at 9 a.m. and it's a 1.4-mile running race. Then you transition and you hop on your bike and you head out for a 12.4-mile bike. And then you come back in, jump off your bike, and go out for another 5K run. So when it's all said and done, you will have tested out definitely running and biking and maybe a little walking if you're not the greatest runner.
And how can people sign up for that? Can they still if they're interested?
Absolutely. You can sign up online through Friday, September 9th, just by going to comecleanduathlon.org. But if you want to come out and sign up on race day on site, that's perfectly acceptable.
Or if you want to volunteer, I'm sure you can use help.
Yes, we are definitely looking for volunteers. On that same website, there's a specific link for volunteering, and we have lots of different shifts. They're about a couple hours long, and you can come out and help marshal along the bike course, cheer people on, direct them along the way. We have lots of refreshments that we need help restocking, registering, checking people in, lots of opportunities to volunteer.
So, Chloe, summarize what you'd want our listeners to know about clean commuting, and what should they keep in mind so that they can commute cleaner?
We all know that getting in your car and driving alone is often the most convenient choice. So we try and make clean commuting just as convenient. And we do that in a couple different ways. One is we have an online ride matching service. So you go to our website, cleancommute.org, and you create a profile and you get to put in all of your commute parameters. You know, I go from this location at this time. I've got about 15 minutes flexibility on my arrival and departure. And out comes a list of any bus routes, biking buddies, carpools, or vanpools that match your needs. The other part is emergencies arise. And let's say you're a carpooler and your kid gets sick and you're not the carpool driver. You don't have a car at work that you can use to go and pick up your sick kid. So we have another program called the Emergency Ride Home Program, and it's essentially insurance that you will have a car available to you in that type of an emergency. And so if you commute cleanly 3 days a week, then every 6 months we will mail you 2 vouchers. And each voucher is good towards a 24-hour rental from Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And they will deliver the vehicle to you, or you can go and pick it up. You can execute any errands that are related to that emergency and drop off the car at any Enterprise location. As long as you stay within that 24-hour time limit, we cover your entire cost, with the exception of you got to return the car with a full tank of gas. I'd like to add that the Tri-County region specifically focuses on limiting ozone emissions. And those are definitely transportation related. And every now and then, the state, I think it's the DEQ, will issue an ozone action day, which means our level of ozone has reached a specific level that it is now unhealthy for certain people to be outside in those air conditions. And that includes people with asthma or chronic respiratory illnesses, youth, children, the elderly, or any active adult who frequently exercises outside. When we reach one of those levels of ozone pollution, it's unsafe for you to be outside. And that's considered an orange alert that they'll issue. And those primarily occur during ozone action season, which is from May to September. And so we really try and focus our public education campaigns during that time frame. And that's why we start off the season in May with a commuter challenge. And we end the season with this duathlon in September.
So, Chloe, you're a recent University of Michigan graduate with a degree in environmental science. What advice do you have to other young people coming up who want to do something career-wise in this still growing and emerging sustainability field?
My biggest piece of advice is make sure while you're still in school, you get some sort of a hands-on experience in the area of environmental science that you're interested in. Because environmental science is such a broad field and there's so much you can do with it that it doesn't naturally transition into a job. You know, I like to say, I didn't major in accounting, so I'm not searching the job boards for the job title of accountant, and I don't then become an accountant. I studied environmental science and specialized in sustainable business, had an internship at the state government, and then now I'm working at a bus company. You know, it wasn't a smooth transition. So it's really key to get some sort of a hands-on experience, be it an internship, a job, an unpaid internship, volunteer experience, something so you can start getting connected to the environmental community in the area that you want to work. Because it's really important to network. And I know that's a buzzword. You know, people say, you got a network, that's the only way you're going to get your job. I didn't know what that was. I had to actually go out and start doing it to learn what that was. And it's really talking to the people in your field, learning what they do, and then sharing with them about what you're interested in and asking if they know someone that you should talk with. So it's really important to network and get a hands-on experience.
And Chloe, you said buzzword. You know, in a way, sustainability has some buzzword to it because it means so many things to so many people. What does it mean to you?
I think I really like the definition of sustainable development. And it kind of harkens back to my days as being a Girl Scout. As a Girl Scout, you're told to always leave a place better than you found it. And that's really what sustainability and sustainable development means to me. I want to leave my world better than it was for the future generations.
Well, Chloe, thanks for joining us. And tell us again what you'd like people to remember about the Clean Commute Options Program and how can they get more information?
Absolutely. Well, first, you should know that all of our services are free. And it's very easy to sign up online to start finding a clean commute option for you. You can do that at cleancommute.org and click the green clean commute login button. And if you have any questions, I'm your resource in the Tri-County region. I am supposed to be visible and active. So you can contact me via email or on the phone or find information on the website. I'm your resource.
That's Chloe White, the Clean Commute Options Coordinator for CATA. That's the Capital Area Transportation Authority. And I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, about a year ago, the Wall Street Journal published a special report on what they called 8 crucial food issues. And one of the 8 was whether food companies should be required to label products made with genetically modified organisms, commonly known as GMOs. Let's fast forward to the end of July when President Obama signed a law, a bipartisan law, that addressed this issue. Here to tell us about the implications of the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act is Jim Zook. Jim is the executive director of the Michigan Corn Growers Association and the Corn Marketing Program of Michigan. Jim, always good to have you on the program.
Kirk, it's always great to be here. We enjoy communicating to your listeners about issues around agriculture.
When we talk about genetically modified organisms or GMOs, what are we talking about?
Well, I think, Kirk, that's the biggest question that we have out there is, what is GMOs? If you go by the true definition of GMO, Kirk, you and I are GMO. We're not exactly like our father. We're not exactly like our mother. And so I think for people to understand, you know, what is GMO, I think is a very first thing. So, you know, we look at this as everybody, all things out there are GMO. So if you label something GMO, you'd have to label everything as GMO. So, you know, going forward, you know, we look at it, we're using this technology so that we can be better stewards of our soils and of what God has given us. And what that does is it allows the science to have traits within our crops, and I'll speak specifically for corn, that will basically help us to reduce adding other chemistries to protect those plants from its full yield potentials.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point. A lot of people out there that I've talked to have the misconception that somehow you're actually injecting an herbicide or a pesticide right into the plant seed. That's not how GMOs work.
No, it's not. And that's why doing this radio spot with you is extremely important, because we are not injecting chemicals into those plants. We are actually have identified proteins within plants that will actually protect that plant from invasive insects or diseases that would hinder its productivity, that may keep it from, you know, getting to its full potential. So we're actually just dealing with the proteins and the cells within the plants. We're not actually adding pesticides within the plants.
100 Nobel laureates have recently put out a letter in support of GMO technology. 100 laureates, many of whom won the Nobel Prize in medicine. And there's a letter that folks can sign on to, which I personally have signed on to. But I think that speaks volumes to the safety of GMOs.
Well, and that's the biggest thing is the fact that it's safe. You know, many people have the presumption, and I'm not going to say that they're not safe, but they believe that some other methods of production are much safer than use of the GMOs. And that may or may not be true. But what we do know is that the crops that we're doing and all the safety factors that we're growing are safe, and they're safe for the human consumption. And again, you know, you got to keep in mind that there are positives that have come out with GMOs. When you talk about golden rice and the vitamins that have been enhanced within that rice for the third world countries, there's positives in the consumers' diets that have came about because of GMO and our technology and sciences.
I'm talking about GMO technology with Jim Zook. Jim is the executive director of the Michigan Corn Growers Association and the Corn Marketing Program of Michigan. Jim, what are some of the other reasons why, let's talk about corn growers here for a moment, why do they use GMOs?
The biggest reason why they use GMOs is the fact that they have reduced the use of pesticides on their crops, because, you know, people need to understand that farmers live in the environment where they work, and they are not going to do anything to jeopardize the health of themselves, the health of their families, their grandchildren. And so, you know, people need to understand that they're living in this environment where GMOs and where these crops and these sciences are being put into practice. So the biggest thing is the fact that they have been able to enhance their yields, their productivity. They have reduced pesticides. We are also getting better utilization of the nutrients that are in the soils as well. So we reduce nutrient applications. And so there is just a wide range of benefits for the environment, for the farmer, and for consumers, because we have been able to adapt this new technology out in the field.
Okay, let's switch over to the Labeling Act that was just signed at the end of July by President Obama. As I mentioned in the intro, it was bipartisan. It was hammered out in the House and the Senate. Senator Stabenow and Senator Roberts from Kansas, again, came up. Very rare in Washington when people can come to a compromise. But in general, agriculture is pleased with this legislation. What about the corn growers?
You know, we are very pleased as well. The reason that we're pleased with this is the fact that it creates that uniform labeling requirement. What would have happened if that would not have gone through would be that many of the food companies, whether it be the Kellogg's or your smaller ma and pa, would have had to create a label for all of the different authorities who were going to create a label for their own jurisdiction. This actually is going to save consumers money, because the food companies will not have to pass this extra cost on to them. And I want to remind consumers that many times this is going to affect the small food producer,
right?
Maybe the guy who's doing pickles, you know, that they have pickles when they package them. It goes across state lines. They sometimes don't know exactly where that bottle or that can is going. And so they would have had to have had a big label on there. So this actually allows those food companies to be more cost effective and really to keep the producers and keep those jobs within those areas that they produce.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because in the legislation, as I understand it, there are different ways of labeling. So if you're a large company, you can do it one way. If you're a smaller company, you can do it with a website or a telephone number.
You know, and that's true. And, you know, there's arguments both ways on all that. But we are in an era where we have technology. There's technology is there, and like the QR code, like you're referring to, that is one way that again we're using technology for the cost effectiveness for consumers, you know. And I guess the big thing about the label too is, you know, people have this misconception or had misconception. Hopefully, after listening to us today, they'll be better understanding. But you know, we were very concerned that having it labeled as a GMO was almost like they were going to put a skull and crossbones on there. Well, what this does is that labeling does not or will not stigmatize the proven and safe technology that we're using here within our crops and our food that we're producing.
And you could comment on this too, but a large company like Campbell's has already come out and said, you know, we're going to do this. We were going to do it regardless. Big companies can afford to do. They could have even afforded to do the 50 different varieties, unfortunately, if we would have had that situation. But they basically are trusting their consumers. They say we're pro GMO. We trust our consumers. We want transparency, so we're going to put the labels on there.
You know, and that's a company choice, you know,
right.
and that's really what we're about is free choice. But we don't want to make sure that, you know, why I guess we're supportive of this legislation is we did not want the labeling to be cost prohibitive for those smaller companies.
Right.
We know that anytime you add costs to those food products, the consumer is going to pay in the end. And I believe that this was a very good solution. The way the bill came out so that we don't have those prohibitive costs to the food companies, which you know are going to get passed right on to the consumer.
And as I understand it, Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but if this goes into effect, I think there's a 2-year window here to figure out exactly how this is going to come down.
Again, the ruling, I believe, as my understanding is, that is going to be left up to the Secretary of Ag to implement this ruling and this labeling requirement, which does have to go into effect within 2 years or sooner, whatever is determined by the Secretary of Ag.
Okay, so the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act goes into effect, operationalized in a couple of years. It's a good thing for Michigan corn growers. I've been talking with Jim Zook, Executive Director of the Michigan Corn Growers Association and the Corn Marketing Program of Michigan. Jim, thanks for the clarity on this new legislation, and always a pleasure having you on the program.
And Kirk, anytime, we love coming in and educating the consumers about where their food comes from.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, Michigan State University has long been at the forefront of research to reverse a very disturbing global problem. That's bee decline. Here to give us some background and a progress report is Dr. Rufus Isaacs. He's an internationally renowned bee researcher and professor of entomology at Michigan State, and his research is supported in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research. Wild native bee populations in Michigan have declined in recent years, and not just in Michigan. What's causing this problem?
What seem to be the major factors driving this is habitat loss. These bees need flowers to feed on during the summer. They also need a place to nest. And as we develop land more, there's fewer places for them to persist. Pesticides and diseases are two of the other factors. And so people are currently really actively exploring all of those and trying to understand what's driving wild bee decline. Across the Midwest, there's been a real change in the number of certain bumblebee species. Some are much, much reduced from where they used to be. But to be honest, we don't know for a lot of the many species of wild bees that we have in the state what their population trends are, because we haven't been monitoring them. So there's a real need to start, you know, a monitoring program that we can look at long-term trends in wild bee abundance.
Rufus, when people hear wild bees, or when we talk about nectar and pollination, mm-hmm. A lot of folks will go straight to honeybees. But honeybees,
yeah,
and wild native bees are different, aren't they?
Well, there is a distinction, because the honeybees that most people are familiar with are originally from Europe, and so they were brought here with the settlers in the 1600s. They were an essential part of life then. We didn't have electricity, so we needed candles, so we needed beeswax. We didn't have refined sugar. We needed sweeteners, so we had honey. You could make mead with honey. There are a lot of reasons why these settlers brought brought the honeybee to the U.S. So that is a very good pollinator and has been turned into a multi-million dollar business for pollinating crops across the country, and that's an essential part of our agriculture. But there are also these 450-something other species that we consider the wild species. They're not managed. They don't have beekeepers. They just persist in the landscape if we give them what they need.
Who are the better pollinators, the honeybees or the wild bees?
Well, it depends how you ask that question. So in terms of total value to Michigan agriculture and Michigan production of crops, the honeybee definitely wins that. We've looked in blueberry farms, for example, in the sites that we work at in western Michigan, and estimate they do about 80, almost 90% of the pollination work totally across the state. But in certain settings where you've got smaller fields with more wild habitat around them, maybe where it's a smaller grower that doesn't contract with a commercial beekeeper, there the honeybees are doing a smaller part of the pollination, and the wild bees really pick up the slack and are really good pollinators of crops like blueberry. So it really depends on where you are. I think efficiency on a per bee basis, bumblebees do well. Some of the wild bees do really well on some of our crops. But in terms of sheer numbers, the honeybee wins that race because they've got the beekeepers and the colonies, thousands.
They've got the population.
Exactly. They've got the abundance, yeah.
With the decline in these indigenous species, though, and you mentioned fruit growers, this has created a problem for those that need to get pollination done at certain times of the year. I understand they have to go to other states sometimes to get the honeybees in.
For a long time, we've brought honeybees into the state from other states. They they often go down to Florida, Georgia during the winter months because it's just too cold to be building numbers of your honeybees in the spring to be able to pollinate those early crops like cherries and blueberries and apples. Beekeepers will often take those out of the state for the parts of the winter and then bring those back really strong, ready to pollinate the crops early in the year. So that's not really such a new thing. But with all the talk of colony collapse disorder that was happening a while ago, there was a lot of concern about the long-term viability of pollination and whether we need to be relying more on wild bees, and that's where some of our research has sort of added to the story here.
Well, speaking of your research, Michigan State is lead in an $8.6 million grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You call it the Crop Pollination Project. You've got a number of collaborators, including the Xerces Pollinator Group. Tell us a little bit about the Crop Pollination Project.
Yeah, so this was actually originally funded in 2012. It's from the USDA, as you mentioned, from their NIFA Specialty Crop Research Initiative, and this is a specific initiative to help vegetable, fruit, and nut growers with their issues. And as I said, one of the issues was sustainability of pollination. So we brought this group together back in the 5-6 years ago now, and we've got 15 institutions around the country, including, as you said, that group based out of Oregon. And we're trying to understand the contribution that wild bees provide to pollination of almonds, blueberries, apples, cherries, pumpkins, watermelon, raspberries around the country. So a lot of these fruit and vegetable and nut crops. Working with a great team, and we have been exploring that through a lot of on-farm work, so working at fruit farms in Michigan. A lot of data collection. We're at the sort of point of trying to figure out what all of that means. Yeah. But it's clear that as you look across agriculture, there are places where honeybees are really important, and then as we get to places that have more wild habitat, more suitable environment around the farm, then we get more of these wild bees. And part of the project is to look at if we deliberately go into these farms and plant habitat for pollinators, can we increase the wild bee abundance, maybe also help the honeybees and help the grower with getting better pollination. And just one study that we did in Michigan in my lab before this project started did demonstrate a little increase in blueberry yield if we set up these pollinator plantings in the farms. So we're supporting those bees with pollen, with nectar, with a place to nest, and that's boosting those wild bee numbers to help the honeybees when it's bloom time in the spring.
My guest is Dr. Rufus Isaacs. He's a bee researcher and a professor in the Department of Entomology at Michigan State University. You mentioned the habitat experiments that you're doing. Farmers are, when you say habitat with respect to bees, that probably, I mean, your research, correct me if I'm wrong, but would have implications for what some of the people listening to this interview can do in their own yards in an effort to support bees.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we are focused in that project on farms, and we have some bigger areas to play with, and growers can help us establish these plantings in some fairly big areas. But yeah, the individual homeowner, gardener, can certainly do a smaller version of this on their own farm, or I mean on their own garden. It's that build it and they will come, Field of Dreams right. kind of effect. So we've got some advice through MSU Extension that we put out on which plants are really good for pollinators. If you look for the Smart Gardening Program. Yeah, the Smart Gardening Program has, with that group, we've put together a series of guidelines for how you can better manage your garden for pollinators. Now, not everybody gets excited about the idea of bees coming into their garden, but a lot of these wild bees are very very docile and wouldn't, you know, they're not out to get you. They're busy getting pollen, getting nectar from the flowers. We also have a pocket guide that we just put together that's for sale through MSU Extension through the MSU bookstore. And that's a little flip guide so people can get more familiar with wild bees. But there's a lot of good guides out there now. And if you can set a little part of your garden aside with some flowering plants that bloom, especially that bloom through the season, that give you blooms from the spring through to the fall with a mix of species, and those resources give you some advice on that, then the bees have a place to feed through the whole summer.
Yeah, I've got the little handbook here. It's called Bees of the Great Lakes Region and Wildflowers to Support Them, a guide for farmers, gardeners, and landscapers, as you mentioned, Rufus, available through MSU Extension. But a lovely little hand guide and something that I'm going
to
read.
I think part of our overall message to the gardeners is that you should use good integrated pest management in your gardening.
Right.
You should only use chemical controls when you absolutely need to, and you should think about the non-intended side effects of using pesticides, especially on flowers that are blooming, that the bees will be visiting directly. So part of that smart gardening program is only using pesticides and only using bee safe. There are a few bee safe pesticides that will only target the pest insect you're after. And just try and be mindful when you're gardening.
Just be judicious when you're using those pesticides in your gardens.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I've been talking with Dr. Rufus Isaacs, internationally renowned bee researcher from Michigan State University, about what you can do out there to help mitigate the problem of bee decline. Rufus, we'll have you back. This project is ongoing, and it'll be interesting to see what some of those other findings turn out to be.
All right. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment.
Hi, I'm Sheila Burkhart with the Michigan Milk Producers Association. This year is a very special year for our organization as we celebrate our 100th anniversary. We're a farmer-owned cooperative marketing milk and dairy products produced by dairy farmers across Michigan and surrounding states. And we trace our roots to May 23, 1916, when the cooperative was founded by a group of dairy farmers who gathered at Michigan State University to find a stable, reliable market for their milk. Over the years, much has changed in the dairy industry. Today, technology is more advanced than ever before. Cows are more productive and farms are more efficient. Logistics allow for Michigan milk products to be shipped around the world, generating new export opportunities for producers. And we continue to grow and expand with new investments, like our whole milk powder packaging system and butter churn installed at our Ovid plant and reverse osmosis technology at our Constantine plant. While there have been many changes, Michigan's important role in the nation's dairy industry remains, and our strong partnership with MSU continues today. In recognition of the 100th anniversary and in honor of that partnership, MMPA announced a donation of $100,000 to Michigan State University. The funding comes from MMPA's Applied Research Fund and will support research for the advancement of the animal agriculture industry in priority areas such as bovine tuberculosis, sustainability, and workforce development. As we celebrate 100 years in business, Michigan milk producers are looking ahead to the future, while honoring those who worked hard to create a successful co-op since 1916.
WKAR. I'm Russ White, and you're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
courtesy of National Public Radio, here's MSU alumnus Don Gagne's piece on MSU's Vincent Voice Library. The piece was part of NPR's Peabody Award-winning Lost and Found Sound series.
Today on our series Lost and Found Sound, a garden of the spoken word growing in Michigan.
Our year-long series, a collaboration between NPR and independent producers, includes a review of how we speak, where we speak, and how we save our words.
I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World, to delight those who have never
seen. Good evening. This is Admiral.
Serve your friends the beer with that new 1952 tape. Y'all to take
it. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
Today I also got a letter from Angel. In his P.S., he said we ski in 43. I sure hope so.
In East Lansing, on the campus of Michigan State University, anyone interested in the history of recorded sound can find two extremely valuable resources. One is the Vincent Voice Library. The other is the man who runs it. NPR's Don Gagne went there to get an earful of both the collection and the collector.
Here is where spoken words are stacked, floor to ceiling, row after row. The famous and the forgotten, some recorded more than a century ago, come to life and actually speak to it.
We bring you an address by Mr. John L. Lewis, President of the United Mine Workers.
My voice tonight will be the voice of millions.
It's quite clear that we have it in our power to create a world in which poverty and hunger are eliminated, in which we can all lead comfortable lives.
If present trends continue, it is possible that by 1980, the slums of Chicago will be but a memory. Never before in our history have there been so much mobilization.
At the 18th Communist Convention, it was decided that they would be able to take over the USA by 1976. Setting up the communist flag in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Independence Hall, July the 4th.
The Vincent Voice Library is named for the man who started it nearly 40 years ago. Robert Vincent had been making recordings since 1912 when he used an Edison wax cylinder to capture the voice of Teddy Roosevelt. As a recording engineer and producer during World War II, he helped establish Armed Forces Radio. He worked on the V-Disc. Those are the unbreakable 78 RPM recordings of Frank Sinatra and others sent to U.S. soldiers during the Second World War.
Hi, man. This is Frank Sinatra. I hope you like these tunes that I've chosen to do for you on these very wonderful V-Discs. And I hope that you get as much a kick out of hearing them as I do out of singing them for you.
He was a sound engineer at the Nuremberg trials and at the UN. And Robert Vincent was a compulsive collector who loved voices and who never threw a recording away.
So many people ask me, what is the value of these old experimental records that were made in the last century? They're novelties. They don't have historical significance. And of course, I disagree very hotly.
Vincent believed that there's no substitute for hearing a person's actual voice. That in vocal pacing and inflection, there is meaning that cannot always be gleaned from words on a page.
It seems almost uncanny that the voice in this place can be perpetuated.
In 1962, Vincent, then retired, donated his entire collection to Michigan State University, and he came with it, cataloging everything.
A lot of people ask me, what is the oldest recording that you have in your whole collection? And I say, well, Henry Morton Stanley. And then they immediately say, well, who was that? I said, well, he's a man that said, Dr. Livingston, I presume. And he said, oh, have you got him saying that? And I said, no, I didn't rush up there with an Edison cylinder phonograph into Africa and record him saying that. Well, this is Henry Morton Stanley, and this recording was made in 1888.
The best use that I can make of this wonder of the age, the phonograph, is to bid you the most hearty welcome and to assure you that we...
The voice you will now hear
is that of the 26th President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt.
In this way, I desire to greet the Boys Progressive League at their meeting at the Hotel Manhattan. I feel that the Progressive
In this recording, made by Robert Vinson 87 years ago, Roosevelt is speaking to a Boy Scout troop.
I wish to see you boys join the Progressive Party and act in that party and as good citizens in the same way I'd expect any one of you to act in a football game. In other words, don't flinch, don't foul, and hit the line hard.
Though no formal ranking exists, the Vincent Library is believed to be the largest collection of its kind anywhere. More than 50,000 voices reside on the shelves here. Since 1974, the library has been run by an old friend and colleague of Robert Vincent's, MSU English professor Maury Crane. Where Vincent was an engineer, a technician, Crane is more the social historian. And since taking over as director, he has increased the size of the collection 20-fold to include almost anything people have been willing to donate over the years. Stuff from their attics, old record collections, radio soaps, political speeches, lectures, press conferences, poets.
I keep adding things, and of course you take gifts because you don't know what's going to be in them. Historians always say the job of the historian is to find the diamonds in the dung heap. I say, fine, and the reason you can do that is the job of the librarian is to catalog dung.
It happened in 1955, another in this new series of programs prepared for your enjoyment and in the interest of your future by the New York Stock Exchange, in cooperation with the United States Treasury Department.
But, Mother, it will take years for me to learn to speak French, and by that time the job will have been filled.
Oh, no, it won't. You'll be speaking French like a native, and in only 4 months.
Impossible to learn to speak a foreign language in a few months? Not in 1955.
It's one thing to say this is a wildly diverse collection of recordings, but it's another to wander the aisles with Maury Crane and look at the labels, many of them handwritten on row after row after row of tape recordings.
And this is all election
These
coverage from 68.
12-inch reels and Neil Armstrong on the moon, Truman's funeral.
Jackie Robinson and Bette Davis, Nixon in Russia. This is the history of railroading in Michigan. We have the oral history of Poultry Husbandry Association in here.
The New York dress is just simply taking the blood and feathers off and everything else remains.
In fact, I think I worked one summer in Swift's plant at Logansport, Indiana in 1934-35.
Michigan State has the biggest library in the world of turf grass, which is grass for golf courses. Somebody's got to have it, and we have it. And these are
Walter
short
Cronkite
versions
the
of...
These are the short
condensed
versions, Shakespeare.
Yeah, right.
Chekhov, Beowulf in Old English,
yes.
NLP.
Recorded by Beowulf himself, yes. Colloquial Danish, for those of you who don't want to speak formal Danish.
The following two dialogues are exchanges between first Jørn and his mother, and then between Pamela and her father-in-law. The in-laws have been invited to lunch.
Må jeg bede om brød, Jørn?
Ja, værsgo. Undskyld, jeg rækker over.
Vil du også række mig osten?
Maury Crane seems to revel in pointing out such oddities, joking that you never know when someone will come in looking for that particular recording. But he also knows that this is a place for serious learning, where students and scholars can gain a better understanding of history. He points to one very old recording of a campaign speech written by William McKinley and either read by McKinley himself or, as some contend, by an actor of the day.
At the turn of the century, the swing vote in any county, any precinct, any state was the illiterate vote. People voted who couldn't read, and that's all right. That's Jacksonian democracy. But everybody had a record player, a sound machine. A man named Len Spencer, who had a great voice, and he was out of vaudeville and out of theater, and he would hire out to people running for office.
My fellow citizens, recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War.
Even for as passionate a collector of sound as Maury Crane, the physical limits at the Voice Library are reining him in. Crane says he no longer accepts old 78s. He's got too many. But stuff does keep pouring in. He's got stacks of recordings still uncatalogued in a storage room nearby. He's got things you can't imagine anyone wanting to hear.
This is an example of the bowel sounds heard with a small bowel obstruction.
Operating.
Listen for the high-pitched,
operates,
tinkling bowel sounds.
Operating.
Containing both the eclectic and the expected, you might think that the Vincent Voice Library represents the sounds and the voices of 100-plus years of U.S. history. Crane says he wishes it did, but that not even this huge and diverse collection can claim that. Instead, he says, the library merely represents the things he has found interesting and worth having on the shelf. It is, in effect, a reflection of the endlessly curious mind of Maury Crane. And that's not a bad thing.
So what you have to have is a little old lady, and that's me. There's got to be a mom and pop grocery store. There's got to be someone who says, I know we've got it, and I know where we can put our finger. You know, it is, it's, yes, we've got a can of that back in the rear, you know, underneath the tuna.
Brød, meaning bread, is a tongue twister for non-Danes.
Milk? Milk?
Crane is now 72 years old with no immediate retirement plans. He is currently working to get funding to convert the entire Vincent Voice Library to some digital format. Once that's completed, he says, he hopes to make the entire collection accessible via the Internet.
Circumstances. Circumstances.
This concludes the section on bowel sounds.
Don Gagne, NPR News, East Lansing, Michigan.
WKAR.
Hi, I'm Jim Zook, Executive Director of the Michigan Corn Growers Association and the Corn Marketing Program of Michigan. With harvest approaching in the next couple of months, crop progress in our state varies widely. In some areas, we'll see an above-average crop, and in others, we'll just see the opposite. Much of the uncertainty is due to the weather we've seen this year. Michigan started off with a wet early season, but soon entered a very dry period. In fact, we were in a drought situation for much of the summer, which persists in some areas. At the same time, during the past 2 weeks, we have seen intense rainfall across lots of mid-Michigan. We expect southern Michigan to have above-average production, while mid-Michigan and areas of the Thumb will be below average. West Michigan should be on track with average production. Overall, we are expecting to be at 8 to 10% less than average statewide in terms of bushels per acre. However, keep a couple things in mind. First, we planted 5% greater amount of corn, which helps to mitigate the decrease in production. Second, corn production and yields have seen steady increases in recent years thanks to technology. We'll be touring the state this fall during our Between the Rows field tours and expect to see wide variances in Michigan's corn farms. But with site-specific agriculture, GPS-steered equipment, soil testing, and more, farmers are still resilient and productive.
WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan Life. The key, says Stephen Covey, is not in spending time, but investing it. You are a person of value. Your quality time is limited, so it's essential that you invest most of it in people who appreciate and reciprocate. Keith Ferrazzi tells us that the only true way to get a return on a relationship investment is to give without the expectation of return. That's great advice. But it's also true that your own soul must have nourishment if it is to have the strength to make a difference in the world. So make sure your portfolio of friends has more than a few reciprocators in it. Our lives are filled with transactional relationships. We pay for something, they provide it, and that's the end of the transaction. People mumble, "Thanks for your business," and "Have a great day" after we've handed over the cash and they hand over the hamburgers, but they don't really mean it. That's not reciprocation. The places we return to time and again are populated with authentic souls who genuinely are interested in us, who are proactive in their interactions, who make us feel like what we do for them really means something, who reflect back the positive energy we try to share, even on the rare occasions when our own energy level is low. This is reciprocation. Reciprocation does not always mean appreciation. The best feedback is honest feedback. Sometimes that hurts. But if it comes from a place of affection, you will ultimately be glad you got it. One of my all-time most popular Monday motivators talks about the importance of de-emphasizing unfulfilling relationships and prioritizing people who care. This is a key to personal growth and chasing happiness. Treat everyone as you want to be treated. But over the long haul, don't invest in people who don't appreciate it. It's okay to give without expecting a return, but not all the time. Long-term relationships don't work if you're the only one who is doing the heavy lifting. People who don't reciprocate aren't necessarily bad people. They may have something going on inside that you don't know about. They may have other priorities, or they might just not be that into you. That's okay. If it feels like a temporary thing, hang in there. If it's a pattern, let him go. You will get some time back to spend on someone else who appreciates you. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.